3, 2, 1. Well over 100,000 gallons of diesel and jet fuel leaked into the beaver ponds and natural wetlands at the spill site near Dunbar. Railroad workers spent the summer picking up fuel and restoring the site, and Railroad Corporation President Frank Turpin is proud of the way it looks.
Talked to Lenny Gorsuch the other day, the Commissioner of Natural Resources, and said that she owed us a little bit for providing a new state park. But we have cleaned the two beaver ponds have been really remade into two very beautiful lakes. They look very attractive now, and the wildlife has returned. We see beavers in the pond now, and foxes around in the area, and from that standpoint, the spill cleanup is going very well, and I'm sure DEC would agree with that. They've been very complimentary of the way that it has been carried out, and especially Fish and Game. Fish and Game is just delighted that really there was no environmental damage of a long-term nature as a result of this spill.
The cost of that cleanup is a blow to the railroad budget, though. Turpin says at $4.5 million, most of the railroad's expected profits for the year were soaked up, too. He still has hopes that the railroad can break even.
This has been a better year than we expected, so I still have hopes that we can at least break even and maybe have a little in the black this year. But when you have to absorb $4.5 million for a cleanup like this, and then another large sum of money for a fire that we had earlier in the year, plus all of the expenses that we had that we did not anticipate with the moose and the very cold weather and the deep snow. If we break even this year, it's our finest achievement.
What has eluded the railroad and investigators is determining what caused the train derailment. 19 cars left the track. For Turpin, one thing that has been ruled out is human error. He says the crew performed perfectly, but any other answers aren't as clear.
This was a very strange one. When you have a derailment, you usually pull the derail cars for sometimes as much as a mile or two before finally they'll turn over or else you realize you have something derailed and you're able to stop the train. This accident didn't behave that way at all. Everything suddenly stopped. We didn't pull those cars, not even a few feet. They just seemed to just stop as if suddenly they hit a tremendous wall that they just couldn't move on. And when you think of the momentum that a heavy train like that has, it's hard to see what you could find that would stop you that quick. And it, from that standpoint, it didn't appear to be rail. And we thought it must be something failed in one of the cars that caused that car to just completely stop and pile all the others up behind it. But when we sorted through the wreckage, we could find nothing that indicated it had failed on the cars. On the other hand, we did find a rail that appeared to have a crack in it, not all the way through, but a small crack in the rail. Now, whether that had something or somehow that failed and caused another failure related to that, I really don't know. But it was a most unusual accident from the standpoint of everything stopped.
Turpin says the Federal Railroad Administration investigated and couldn't find anything improper, and another expert the railroad called in also left mystified. They'll keep trying to find an answer, but Turpin isn't optimistic they will.
We will continue as we sort through the wreckage. Our people will look to see if there's anything that obviously they can find that went wrong, but I'm afraid we'll never know for sure.
For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
The accident occurred here at Dunbar Siding when 19 tank cars derailed and spilled about 160,000 gallons of fuel oil. When it happened, the cars piled up for several hundred feet, digging 4 feet gashes into the ground. The gashes are filled in now. All that remains are two large piles of oil-soaked debris that were pulled from the two ponds on each side of the site. Oddly enough, it was the ponds which prevented the oil from flowing into Goldstream Creek just a few yards away. Pete McGee is with the Department of Environmental Conservation. He says the two beavers that died indirectly saved a lot of other wildlife.
To have those two beaver ponds there and the beaver dams in place that caught almost all that fuel was amazingly lucky. It would have been a totally different situation if it had spilled, a quarter of a mile further north on the tracks right at the bridge crossing Goldstream Creek and dumped it into the creek, and it would have flown out into the Minto Flats Refuge. I mean, that would have been a much more serious environmental problem.
Although the railroad was lucky, it came under fire for not using that luck to its advantage. Instead of cleaning up right away, officials chose instead to concentrate on fixing the trek. They squandered four precious days. Now, though, O.B. Weeks, the chief engineer for the railroad, says they learned their lesson.
Looking back on it, if we'd have known then what to do, we could have responded quicker, but we didn't know exactly what was going to be done or how to attack it. And cleaning up oil spills, I think, is like kind of like cleaning up derailments. Everyone's going to be a little bit different.
Weeks says an immediate response would have saved the railroad much of the $5 million it spent cleaning up the spill. In hopes of doing better next time, officials are putting together an emergency response plan. Although the railroad was criticized early by the Department of Environmental Conservation, they've since gotten back onto their good side. Doug Dasher is an environmental engineer from DEC. He likes to refer to the oil as product.
The site has been well worked on to remove much of the free product. There's still, of course, some absorbed product in the soil. The ponds, a lot of the product has been removed, or the free product virtually gone off of the ponds. There's been a major improvement to the site. Of course, a wrecked site, you still have the debris and the trees that were taken down. But for a site with a spill that happened out here, I think they've done quite well.
Today will be the last day work crews will be at the spill site. They've begun a bioremediation project which uses organisms to eat the remaining oil, but they'll be back next spring to help nature along. And at Dunbar Siding, this is John McWhorter.
3, 2, 1. Tom Moyer and Charlie Parr have a lot in common. Both are former state employees with a high regard for public office, and each thinks he is the best choice to replace fellow Democrat Mike Davis in Juneau. 12-year Alaska resident Tom Moyer has worked for both Davis and Senator Betty Fahrenkamp. He sees a good representative as one who will protect the personal freedoms District 19 residents enjoy. That's among the things he'd like to work for in Juneau.
There are several issues of interest to me that I think would be of interest to not just the District 19 residents, but statewide, and that is trying to restore some of the faith and trust in government by sending good people to Juneau who will behave in a proper manner. There are some changes in the way the legislature does business that I've seen close up that I think need to be addressed. Certainly, we can increase our tourism opportunities here in Fairbanks. We've got something we can market, the winter and the shoulder seasons. We've seen a really wonderful explosion of activity with the Soviet Union, and I think that can be turned into trade opportunities that will benefit the entire state.
Like Moyer, Charlie Parr sees his experience in state government as a plus for the job. The son of a former legislator, Parr has lived here 28 years. He also has a long agenda for the job.
I have a strong interest in education. I was a single parent for 12 years, and you know, I know how important daycare is to our families. I worked for the state for 6 years, and I built budgets from the bottom up. And nowhere to look for inconsistencies in budgets. And I also know that there are so many things that we as citizens require our state bureaucracy to do that we either have to take responsibility for that, or we have to eliminate some of those requirements so that we can run government more efficiently. We can't ever run it like a business. Our state procurement code is a very prime example. It just frequently, the cost of acquiring goods or services exceeds the cost of the goods or services themselves. And, you know, I wanted to be able to do something about that. Our personnel system needs to be made a lot more workable. You know, and there's quite a few other things like that.
Both Parr and Moyer are pro-choice, and each also supports a court challenge to provisions of the Alaska Lands Act pertaining to subsistence. Voters in District 19, which includes Fort Wainwright, Esther, Fox, Goldstream, Circle, and Central, can choose between the two in Tuesday's primary. We'll offer a look at the Republican candidates for the seat on Monday. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Three longtime observers of Alaska's political system are hoping to replace Mike Davis in the legislature, but these three carry an R behind their names instead of a D. Robert Ault, John Reeves, and Rose Rabacek are vying for office for the first time, and they hope voters are ready to send a Republican to do the job. John Reeves was the first to enter the race, noting that's the mark of a leader. Since moving here permanently in 1974, Reeves has worked in mining, labor, and for the state. He's currently involved in the tourism industry, running Gold Dredge No. 8. Reeves says he's liberal on social issues, but is fiscally conservative, and plans to cut waste from the state budget. He says important state services could benefit if money's redirected. Specifically, he thinks the state's prisoners are eating better than the school kids.
I've started collecting their menus back in November, and they do eat not only better than our kids, but better than most people that live here in Fairbanks. Every Friday night is the infamous prawn halibut menu. They eat wonderful. They have a breakfast that would rival many Sunday brunches in this town. And the way I figure it, and not to pick on the prisoners, but when we're feeding kids stuff, we feed them. And I guess you can best use the word pablum. And then our prisoners are having gourmet meals. I think we got a little problem. And I think that we can take some money out of their diet and put it into the school system. That's one way you can do it.
Reeves says the only campaign promise he's made is to try to get power to the Chattanooga River on the Elliott Highway. He'd also like to see better roads in parts of the district. The state budget is also one of the main targets of Robert Ault, a resident of the Goldstream Valley for more than 20 years. Ault sees lots of problems with the state budget, problems he wants to go to Juneau to tackle.
There appears to be a lot of fat, and there also appears to be a lot of frivolous spending in the budget. The first thing I think the state legislature has to do is get a hand on state spending. Let's take a look at, to me, this is wasteful spending. The state spends over $35 million a year in travel. When you figure that out on a per capita basis per employee in some state agencies, you're looking at each employee spending upwards to $4,000 a year in travel. I think this can be safely cut without affecting any budgets or any programs. The telephone can get a lot done, and it's a lot cheaper. Duplication. There are two state agencies and two boards within the state, all concerned with tourism. To me, it would be more cost effective to have one state board coordinating all advertising and efforts to promote tourism, not two, because sometimes you will cross-duplicate your efforts, and sometimes you will be working against each other. I think there can be savings there.
Ault has done many things since coming to Alaska, too. A manufacturer of gold nugget jewelry, Ault has also been a banker and a miner. Mining has also played a major role in the life of the third candidate, Rose Rabacek, a 32-year Alaska resident. Like Reeves and Ault, Rabacek believes the state budget needs some streamlining.
We need to, first of all, cut our budget. We need to get it down into a reasonable area. We need to protect the permanent fund and continue to make sure that it grows. But one of the ways that we can encourage the economy is through the development of our mining mineral resources. Alaska has an overabundant supply of mineral resources. There's a little province in Russia that's about the same size as Alaska, with about the same number of people as Alaska. It has a colder climate than we have, Magadan province. There are 85,000 people there employed in the mines, and our natural resources are on equivalent, if not better, than theirs. We have about 4,000. So I think that there are things that the state can do to encourage development, not only of our mineral resources, but of some of our other vast resources.
All three candidates consider themselves pro-development. Rabacek differs from her opponents on the issues of abortion and the gambling initiative. Reeves and Ault are both pro-choice. Rabacek favors some restrictions on abortion. Reeves and Ault also support local choice on the gambling issue. Rabacek says she could consider some types of gambling, but is worried about the idea of casino-style gambling in Alaska. That issue will be decided tomorrow, as will the Republican nominee in District 19. The winner will run against either Charlie Parr or Tom Moyer in the November general election. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. Getting the measure on the ballot was a struggle in itself. It failed once, and the five men who supported it had to wait for Assemblyman Chris Birch to get back to town. He provided the sixth vote needed to send the $2 million bond issue to the voters. The $2 million would be used to build three new buildings where rural residents could dump their garbage. Those new garbage collection sites would replace borough dumpsters. Even though rural residents would pay for the buildings, voters in the cities must approve the bond issue as well. Organizers first wanted to have two questions on the ballot, one for rural and one for urban voters. Both would have to pass for the bonds to be issued. But since that was confusing for some assembly members, John Davies asked that they go with one ballot question instead. That only added to Assemblymember Donna Gilbert's complaints that the whole issue wasn't clear.
So in other words, whether these people want this or not, they could say a definite no, the people would have to pay the bill, but the city can say yes, and the votes can outnumber that, and the non-area-wide are still going to pick up the bill.
Mm-hmm. That's wrong. My understanding is that this would have to pass separately, both inside the cities and outside the cities.
Now, wait a minute, Mr. Davies. This is what I'm asking. We're down to one proposition.
That's right.
So
this one proposition would have to pass.
Then what you're telling me is they're going to separate the votes. If the city says yes and the borough residents say no, even though the votes say yes in an overall, then it doesn't go.
That's correct.
Is that correct, Mr. Hardy?
Yes, ma'am. It has to pass both inside and outside the city. If the city residents say no and the outside the city say yes, it fails. If the inside the city says yes and the outside the city says no, it fails. But if they both say yes, then and only then does it pass.
So we're going to be separating all these votes to say this was a city vote that said yes versus this is a versus the North Pole, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. I don't know how the clerk's going to be doing that.
Gilbert continued to object to the measure, saying it's been changed every time it's been discussed, a clear indication that it just isn't ready for voter scrutiny.
And I'll say it again, it's not ready to be put to the voters. I've never said that they weren't a good idea. What I said is do the homework, get it done right, and put a good document before the voters. Since you brought this to the floor, this was, what, substitute number three or four? I don't know how many we've gone through. And every time you bring it to the floor, supposedly it's ready to go to the voters. Tonight it was ready to go to the voters. Had you passed it the other night, it would have gone to the voters. And tonight again, you've made three different amendments.
But John Davies, who has labored over the ballot measure, took exception to those complaints.
The fact is that I gave the original document that we put together to Donna a long time ago, more than a month ago, and she has not bothered to provide me one iota of constructive criticism on that document. She has chosen rather to go out on the radio stations, and she's chosen to take pot shots at the assembly meeting. She has not made one piece of constructive criticism to this effort, even though at the time I gave her the document, she sat on the subcommittee. And so I would ask her to please stop characterizing this effort as being some kind of pig-in-a-poke effort, something that we're trying to hide from the voters. Rather, we're doing exactly the opposite. We're trying to bring something forward. We're asking for discussion. That's why we are flexible. We're willing to try to change this thing to make it something that everybody can support. We're looking for your constructive criticism.
And Hank Hove argued that the changes were only efforts to improve the measure.
It is certainly true, as she's pointed out, that the document was not perfect when it was first presented to us, and I might go as far as to say that it's not perfect now. But what it has been undergoing, the last time we addressed it and this evening when we're addressing it, what it's been undergoing is that natural political process, and politics is the art of compromise. And what has been happening here is that amendments have been offered that have been designed in such a way as to respond to the criticisms that have been leveled against the concept.
Now that the measure is on the ballot, the lobbying campaign begins. depending on the interest rate they get on the bonds. Estimates are that it could cost rural residents $12 to $14 annually to pay off the bonds. But this is just the first step to change the borough's garbage collection system, and critics of the plan object to the unknown costs that lie ahead. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
Well, I think that for a long time we've had very high quality faculty and students and programs, and we felt like our real shortcoming has been our facility. So we think this launches a new era in science at UAF. It's done wonders for the morale of our faculty and our students, and it certainly is going to help us in recruiting new faculty.
We realized as we did that work that nothing substantial was going to be done in Washington about energy planning and energy strategy until some emergency took place, and now we've got one. We've got our troops standing by on the Saudi peninsula, and they may or may not have to go to war. That's a pretty graphic result of short-sighted energy policy, and from now on, if we don't come to terms with our need to both to conserve and to develop domestic production, we're going to have to keep doing that time after time after time. Usually results come from some catalyst, some catalyzing event, just like the oil spill legislation in the Congress was directly caused by the Exxon Valdez. I suspect that all of a sudden people in the Congress realize they have to take a serious look at developing the ANWR. It's a logical piece to the solution of national energy dependency on a region that will be politically unstable for years and years to come. It's not wise. It'll hurt us.
3, 2, 1. The only contested race locally was for the state representative job in District 19. Three of the five candidates are out now, leaving Democrat Tom Moyer and Republican Rose Rabacek to compete in the general election. Moyer got the most support with nearly 33% of the vote. His Democratic opponent, Charlie Parr, garnered nearly 20%. Of the three Republicans, Rabacek had 28% of the voters' support. John Reeves followed with nearly 15%, and Robert Ault was a distant third. Neither Moyer or Rabacek is taking anything for granted with the general election 10 weeks away. Rabacek thinks the issues now will center on development.
I think it's going to be a very uphill battle. I think it's going to be a hard race. I think it's going to be a hard fight. And financial support is very important. And he has been able to raise several times more money than I have during this period of time. And if that vein continues, it's difficult to combat large, well-funded campaigns. But as I said, I think it's time for a change. And I don't think that Tom offers that change to District 19. So I think that the voters will decide.
Rabacek credited the committee that worked on her campaign for her victory. And Tom Moyer attributed his success to the combination of media, printed materials, and personal contacts.
We tried to build some momentum for the fall by running an aggressive campaign, knowing that with an open seat, this will be quite a race.
Moyer says he's been fortunate to raise the kind of money he did so that his goals were easier to accomplish, and he thinks this primary victory will only help that effort. He also looks forward to an issue-oriented campaign.
Things important to the district: roads, emergency services, schools, and the broader issues of the budget and some of the freedoms, pro-choice issue.
There was also a primary contest in District 17 where incumbent Representative Dick Schultz edged challenger Bob Carnahan. Schultz had 50% of the vote. He'll face Democrat Ruby John in November. Other local state house seats were uncontested in the primary, but those candidates got an idea of what kind of support they have going into November. Incumbents led challengers in all those races. Senator Betty Fahrenkamp earned nearly 60% of the vote to Joe Ryan's 40%. Representative Bert Sharp had 67% of the vote compared to challenger Franklin Eagle's 33%. Representative Mark Boyer, facing another challenge from Urban Rahoy, had more than 57% of the vote. Ray Hoy had 42%. And 54% of the voters in House District 21 supported Nilo Kopanen. Bev Bennett earned more than 45% of the vote there. In all, voter turnout in Fairbanks was nearly 44%. As happened statewide, voters here rejected the two initiatives on the ballot. Fairbanks voters also supported congressional incumbents Ted Stevens and Don Young in big numbers. In the races for the state's two top offices, voters here supported Jack Hoghill for lieutenant governor, with Democrat Willie Hensley a distant second. It's the governor's race that could be a tough one for Fairbanks voters. In the primary, Fairbanks area districts supported Rick Halford for governor, followed by Jim Campbell and then Stephen McAlpine. Tony Knowles and Arlister Jaluski are fourth and fifth on the local election returns list, with 18% and 12% of the vote, respectively. And those two, along with Alaska Independence Party candidate John Lindauer, will likely battle for the governor's job this fall. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. Republican Arlister Jaluski only captured 12% of the Fairbanks vote, but Senator Jack Hoghill was the leading vote-getter in the race for lieutenant governor, and in Fairbanks, he beat his opponents by better than a 2-to-1 margin. Although the two Republicans differ politically, the more conservative Coghill thinks the combination makes a better ticket than the Democrats will field.
I'm going to be promoting the First Lady Governor of Alaska, number one. Number two is that I think that we bring a better balance as far as conservatives versus the liberal element. I think that we bring a lot better balance as far as government interfacing with business. I think that we bring a better balance as far as regional areas are concerned and historical values. So I think we bring a better balance, and we bring something to the future generation of Alaska that the other team is not going to be able to bring.
On the Democratic side, gubernatorial candidate Tony Knowles says he and Lieutenant Governor candidate Willie Hensley will present a positive, unified approach. That's something Knowles isn't sure the Republicans can say at this point.
I think there's some problems in reference to what kind of decision process the other campaign's going to have, and who's going to be what kind of platform and agenda and the direction they're going in, and they're going to have to define that. It's going to be it'll be interesting.
Even though Knowles and Sturgeluski both lagged behind Rick Halford in capturing the Fairbanks vote, Knowles was reassured with his 18% support here, only slightly behind Jim Campbell and Stephen McAlpine. He says the key to improving his showing here is unity.
The primary point in terms of an election is people feel that they can participate in a meaningful way in terms of the development of the area for economic prosperity. There's a lot of really great things going on. The state needs to be supportive of that. There also has to be a feeling that Alaskans are coming together, and I think there really does need to be some bridges built between regions, between cities, and between urban and rural, and that's going to be an important part of Alaska's success. And also just physically, I will be there in Fairbanks often. I think getting to know people and work with them on a face-to-face and shoulder-to-shoulder, and that's the very best part of politics.
For her part, Sturgeluski ran a positive campaign in the primary, and she'd like to see issues remain the most important part of the fall campaign.
The kind of campaign I want is one that talks about how we're going to handle the budget, how development is going to take place, the relationship of government to the private sector, the relationship of government to the environment. Those are the issues that we ought to talk about. We ought to talk about daycare. We ought to talk about education. We ought to talk about the permanent fund and what's important to Alaskans.
Before the fall election campaigns get into full swing, local voters' attention will be focused on municipal elections. They take place October 3rd. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. The task force looked at a number of homes in Fairbanks that cannot be sold under the AHFC's existing rules. The houses must first meet safe, sound, and sanitary conditions, but it costs too much to bring them up to those standards, and some of the homes just aren't worth it. So the so-called problem properties have piled up as Alaskan Home Properties, the AHFC's marketing division, decides whether they should be repaired and sold or destroyed. The volunteer task force submitted its suggestions last month. It was headed by Frank Lang of Alaskan Home Properties.
The standard right now of repair for Alaska housing properties is that we bring them to a safe, sound, and sanitary condition. What we were looking for in our recommendation was that we somehow relax that standard a bit so that we look at things which are more imminent as just saying safe, sound, and sanitary, like establishing that with an engineer's report. And so if we could look at something that would relax the standard a little bit so that we'd get these houses back into the hands of the public.
The task force suggested in some cases that a minimum amount of work be done to the buildings to make them safe and then sell them as is. Others should have any hazards removed and then be sold as is. And a proposal that the AHFC is already working on would allow the buildings to be sold after the buyer agrees to upgrade it to minimum standards himself. Once he's done the work, the deed would be transferred to the new owner. The AHFC's executive director, Tom Behan, says he intends to implement as many of the recommendations he can as soon as he can. The fact that the AHFC is held to strict standards is what makes the process more complicated.
We're held to certain standards that other institutional sellers are not. We're not trying to circumvent that in terms of providing safe, sound, and sanitary homes to the public, but we're trying to find better ways to facilitate it without us having to do a lot of the work that we're institutionally doing now. And when we do it, it causes delays, it causes perhaps more expense than an alternative when someone in the private sector, with a lot of flexibility, perhaps can do the same work.
The task force also recommended that the AHFC adopt minimum construction standards for homes in the future to make sure this same problem doesn't happen again. Behan says the AHFC will have to look at an answer to keep the backlog from growing.
Well, there's 200 problem homes right now, but there are perhaps many more to come unless we can find some practical solutions to these problems that are in this first group of 200. And the problems won't go away. The solutions have to be identified and implemented, and then we can deal with any future problems as they come along.
And Task Force Chairman Frank Lang thinks that working on these solutions will start to address backlog and get some of the properties on the market again.
In our office here in Fairbanks, we have so many calls every day, people wanting to buy as-is properties. It would be great for the public. It would be a solution for us to be able to do it.
For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
I happened to have, a couple years ago, done an analysis on a spreadsheet on my home computer, taking the results of the league straw poll and comparing them to the actual election results when they came out. And with a few exceptions, the results are very close. In other words, someone who prevails in the league straw poll actually prevails at the poll. There are a few noticeable biases. One is local candidates tend to do better here than they do in a statewide election. And also, I think in some cases, women candidates tend to prevail a little higher on our poll. But overall, the results, the correlation between the league straw poll and the overall election results are remarkably analogous.
3, 2, 1. Patrick O'Rourke says it's time to move on. O'Rourke hasn't made any secret of his desire to change jobs. He applied for other positions last spring, including that of University of Alaska System President, a job that eventually went to Jerome Commissar, even though O'Rourke was a finalist for the position.
People might have observed that last spring I had shown a certain restlessness to do something different, and that doesn't stem from anything other than my own internal restlessness. It's 10 years this year for me as chancellor. That's a relatively long period of time in higher ed administration. And once you start feeling that itchiness to do something else, I think you should follow through on it.
O'Rourke told faculty and staff that he'll be leaving the job in June of 1991. That means there will be plenty of time to find a new chancellor and make a smooth transition. O'Rourke says he doesn't know if he'll stay in Alaska or stay in higher education. His job search could lead to a change either way.
Both Charles and I are open. We I'm a 26-year Alaskan. She's a 20-year Alaskan. So our dilemma is probably one of whether or not we will stay in higher education or in Alaska. They may be mutually exclusive at this point in time. If our decision is to stay in higher ed administration, that'll most probably be in the lower 48 someplace. If our decision is to stay in Alaska, that'll probably mean not in higher education, but in some other field.
For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
They have authorization under state law to go out on strike.
We are giving them until 5 o'clock to respond to us, to set up a meeting with us, to come back to the table, to discuss our differences and get on with arriving at a contract.
I have to rethink what it is that has been delegated to me as an authority to act for the mayor as administrative director. I have to take into consideration the actions taken at the last time we had a meeting with the APA, in which the APA said not only no, but hell no, to some possible negotiating points that we had mentioned to them. I guess I'll just have to think about it.
It was close to 7 p.m. Monday, a gray, rainy evening, when villagers first spotted the lone figure on the opposite bank of the Yukon. In the calm air, they could hear his cry for help across the three-quarter-mile wide river. Quickly, a boat was sent to his aid. The lone figure turned out to be Fred Brandon, pilot of a twin-engine plane that almost 4 hours earlier had crashed in a thick stand of cottonwood and spruce some 3 miles upriver, a quarter of a mile off the bank. As fast as they could, the people of Caltag organized a rescue operation, gathering stretchers, blankets, and equipment, and headed back upriver with 8 boats to find the way back into the crash site. The pilot had given them good directions, and after some searching, Carlson Alexi, another of the survivors who'd made it to the riverbank, was spotted. A steep cut bank and thick brush made moving up and through the forest a difficult task, but Monday, under cold, drizzly skies, with lives at stake, difficult conditions were conquered by supreme effort. As fast as they could, the rescuers moved through the thick undergrowth to the charred wreckage. Darkness was descending. Quickly, the three most injured were placed on stretchers. The men lifted them and started back through the woods. An axe man worked furiously ahead, cutting a path. Back on the bank, more boats arrived. Just as quickly, the cut bank was shoveled to a walkable grade, and the path started in. Soon, those on stretchers were brought out. The less seriously injured were carried out in the arms of village men. Meanwhile, the weather had closed in even more, turning back attempts by medical personnel from Galena to reach the community. For the next few hours, it was the village health aides who rose to the challenge, working to stabilize and comfort not just victims, but people who were neighbors, friends, relatives. Where supplies were lacking, the people of Caltag provided. Sheets and blankets were brought in. According to one resident, the small clinic was as packed as could be. Then sometime around 10 p.m., the clouds lifted somewhat. Visibility by one estimate was 4 miles. Quickly, a call was made to Galena and a twin-engine plane with 3 medical professionals dispatched. As soon as they arrived, they went to work. And as quickly as each victim was stabilized, they were moved to the airstrip and loaded aboard the aircraft. In the wet darkness of early Tuesday morning, the plane left Caltag on the emergency return flight to Galena. 4 survivors on stretchers, 4 sitting up. From there, they were sent to hospitals in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and finally Seattle. In all, there were 10 people on the ill-fated Monday flight. 2, the youngest 2, perished in the crash. Tuesday, another, their father, died in a Seattle hospital. Although it offers small consolation to the people of Caltag, they must know that they, in their selfless efforts, have brought a glimpse of human triumph to an otherwise tragic event. In McGrath, I'm Mike Lane.